All right, everyone. Welcome back to another amazing episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. Pizza Mind here, joined by my amazing co-host, Bryce Paul. Bryce, how you doing today?
How are we doing, Pizza Mind? I'm all right. Volatility in the markets was paramount this week. We saw the UST, Terra blockchain kind of get clogged up. The stable coin became not so stable. And so it was a really wild week, and we're kind of just watching the dust settle. So how am I? I am shell-shocked, to say the least.
Shell-shocked.
Excited, nonetheless.
Well, I'm going to take care of you, Bryce, because every time something crazy happens in the world or in the markets, we always say, when in doubt, zoom out. Mm-hmm. And with us today, our guest has been around, seen it all, done it all, and can give us a really broad view of the history of digital currency. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome David Shaum from the XX Network. Welcome to the Crypto 101 podcast.
Hey, you guys. It's a pleasure to be here. Last, thank you.
Yeah.
And it's great to have you. You, for any listeners that have not heard your name and just immediately pulled over and went, what? You're essentially the godfather of cryptography itself and one of the very first people to even attempt something like digital cash on the internet all the way back in the 80s.
It's true. Yeah, that's right. Yes, my I had the DigiCash company in the Netherlands, and the first World Wide Web conference was in CERN, you know, where Berners-Lee had created the web, and I gave the first keynote there. Wow. And I made a payment from Geneva to Amsterdam. It was the first e-cash payment, and then it was pretty widely reported in all kinds of media, and people started recognizing me in elevators and on the street and stuff. And it was a big deal. The idea that a number could be worth money was pretty revolutionary in those days. And but this was a follow-on from work that I'd done at Berkeley in the that was mid-90s, in the early 80s, and actually the end of the 70s. If you can imagine, I was concerned about privacy and the whole unfolding digital world, and how critical it would be to have stuff you could trust and stuff that was private. And so I started working on like voting systems as a kind of little toy kind of, application where some of these issues were present and important in a relatively simple form. And, I kind of threw together my dissertation, which was like a bunch of computers that all had to vote and only could change keys and do things by, add new nodes and so on by majority rule. So it was kind of like a little blockchain thing that I had going. And if you read my dissertation, which you can see on my website, actually, now it was in the library and not, some people had checked it out, but it wasn't online until recently. But it said chain of blocks, I think, or something like that. Before, the web or anything. And, this was about the time that the National Security Agency, the head of it, the new head, decided that there should be no conferences on cryptography, no sessions at conferences. Cryptography was to be, born classified, like nuclear secrets. And so he threatened to throw the whole book, at anyone who would even think about doing this. He wrote letters to the IEEE and the ACM, the big computer organizations at the time. And so being a graduate student at Berkeley, realizing how important all this stuff would be for the free world, I decided to organize a conference on cryptography. And I stuffed the envelopes, I got the list on a paper printout, never talked about it over the phone. You know, it was printed at the same little printing shop that printed the Free Press in those days down on Telegraph Avenue, mailed it out. You know, there were over 100 people that showed up in Santa Barbara at the USEN, actually, Bryce, right there.
Looking out on the, exactly. UCSB. And,
yeah. And it was, you know, we launched the International Association for Cryptologic Research at that event, and that kind of, you know, put the damper on the NSA's plans to suppress research in modern cryptography. And they were all, there was a handful of them there, kind of incognito, you know, they thought. They all had like personal addresses only in Laurel, Maryland. You know, they didn't say NSA on their badges, but they realized what happened. They were all kind of sitting in the front row, you know, in their suits and everything, and sort of turning green. Because we announced the like a successor event in Italy and so on. And so that was setting cryptography free. You know, I could have spent my whole life in jail, I think.
I mean, you were a true crypto revolutionary.
I look back on it now and I realize what serious stuff I was, you know, at the time. I thought, well, you've got to do the right thing here. But, you know, you don't want to mess with those guys. And then... later that technology for payments, which, you know, was launched, as you mentioned, in the Netherlands, I had this, the DigiCash company. And so we made it for the, we licensed it to Deutsche Bank, which was the largest bank in Europe at the time. And then we had banks on all continents. They were issuing it in national currencies, you know. And then there was also our own currency called Cyberbucks that we issued. And so there were like 100 merchants that accepted Cyberbucks. That's like Bitcoin. We just said, oh, we're going to issue 1 million Cyberbucks. That's it or something. If you go to chom.com/ecash, you can see the whole eCash museum, all the press releases and photos. And there's the list of all the, you can actually click on the shops and see what, a lot of cases, what they were selling for the Cyberbucks currency back then. And this was, okay, it wasn't decentralized. It wasn't a blockchain like my dissertation had been, but it was a powerful kind of electronic money for the consumer in the sense that it was based on what I call the blind signature. And so what it meant is that the bank that you withdrew this fiat from or these cyberbucks from could not learn what your money would look like when you went to spend it. So it was fully hidden when they signed it, and then you could unhide it and spend it. And this guaranteed that they couldn't take your money away from you, and they couldn't tell where you were spending it. And that protection was, you know, we'd say today quantum secure. You know, it was information theoretically secure, unconditional. And so there's a powerful type of thing, even though, okay, the bank, you know, this was a commercial bank where you had an account. So that part was usual. But the rest was highly, highly protected for the individuals.
So what were the headwinds that kept this from, you know, becoming the next debit card?
That's a great question. And, you know, I usually sort of punt on that because it's hard to say. There were so many things, but you can imagine that in those days, I mean, just to get on a new software release for us was pretty big deal because Microsoft Windows was, you know, we were three, you know, it's running on like 386s in those days. It was difficult. And
yeah, you can't even just download it. We take that for granted now.
Yeah, it wasn't the technology stack back then. Everyone, mobile phones and all that was like, it was pretty tough and it was slow. You know, you think of, you know, we don't notice this time it takes for cryptography to run today, but in those days it took like a minute or something to make a signature. You know, it was really slow and everything. But the other thing is that I think, you know, the web, it took off at an astronomical pace, you know, there was a tremendous acceleration of build out. And you remember in those days, people were really afraid to use credit cards and all that. And, you know, I think it was a good run. Well, we did prove that this stuff could work and that privacy and payments was an acceptable and achievable thing. And yeah.
When you started a cryptocurrency, you know, decades ago, and you were kind of the only guy doing it. And now fast forward to the 2000s and, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto and all the cypherpunks come around and they make Bitcoin and they kind of bloom this entire new industry. And then, you know, people started forking the code, making other cryptocurrencies, Litecoin, Dogecoin, Ethereum comes around with its own new idea of a general purpose computing platform for blockchains. And then this entire crypto industry of DeFi and NFTs blossom. And we have, you know, this kind of vibrant ecosystem of culture and money. And what do you make of all this? Is this the industry that kind of you envisioned, you know, back in the 70s and 80s when you were thinking about this stuff, or have things kind of taken a turn? What's your interpretation of where we're at right now?
Well, to be extremely frank, you know, the cypherpunks were there, you know, sort of all along, you know, when I was helping them and hosting them and subsidizing them and befriending them and open sourcing. You see, the other thing I didn't mention is the Mix software, which I also created at Berkeley in the late 70s and open sourced. And it's gone through a whole series of incarnations, like Tor is probably the most famous of them, right? So that's an important—
Yeah, Tor is a very popular and important
second
protocol.
Ingredient, basically, for the XX network, right? We have sort of this quantum resistant blockchain thing and the CMIX mixed in, which I could speak to that. But the point is that my take on things was always a little different from the, you know, mega libertarian, let's go, you know, shoot some automatic weapons and blow some stuff up in the desert people, you know, who I knew and I was friendly with them, but I wasn't, it was a slightly different group. You know, I was thinking to myself, you know, this is powerful technology. It could really solve the privacy problem. It could empower people in the information age. You know, this is important stuff. Someone should take the tack that maybe it's not something that has to be, you know, done in spite of government. You know what I mean? You know, it's like, you know, if the government wants to come after you and shut you down, you know, probably they can. You know, it's really fun if you're a young person and you think, oh, we're going to do this and there's nothing they can do to stop us. You know, well, it's a bit naive and it's a bit self, you know, it's an infatuation. You have these, you know, these kind of movements that where, you know, you would do more in a group like that than you would do if you were just left your own thoughts about what would be a reasonable thing to do, right? So everyone sort of eggs each other on and so forth. So, you know, it is what it is. I think that's a legitimate way to go, but I think there's another way, which is to see if you can argue that it is a sensible thing from a, you know, business societal point of view. Can you really solve the issues of, you know, abuse and provide real value and so on? And so, like, I, you know, wrote articles for Scientific American, and I, you know, burned myself out flying around the, you know, country, the planet, really, talking to all kinds of privacy people and giving all kinds of presentations. I guess we get this idea out that you could, what I call it is like security without identification. So back in the, you know, people still conflate the two, right? They think, oh, you got an ID for security. No, it's a different thing. You know, society needs to be protected against abuse, but you as an individual can really only be protected if your privacy is protected. And you can't really count on people to do that because the law says they have to do it. That's sort of the realization. Now, I've been involved in legal groups, you know, to try to push for sending the amicus briefs and all this stuff. I've been doing that for years, but it's not that effective. There's limits, you know, because people can make copies of data and, you know, use it for bad purposes. And you can't really solve the problem fully legally, in my opinion. The much better way, at least, would be to do it where the your private information is simply not released. But so then the problem is, how can you provide what we call technically authentication? How can you convince people, prove to them, whatever, assure them that the money is really valid and so on without having to allow it to be traced to you? And that's kind of like what that blind signature did. But then if you want to protect privacy, you need also the mixing network thing, which is like, if everything you do is tied to your IP address, then you're kind of spinning the wheels. You know, you're fooling yourself. You're not really able to have any privacy because everything can be linked together from that.
Makes sense. So that's a great segue into the XX network, which is your latest incarnation. What is the XX network, first of all, and what are the goals that it's trying to achieve?
Well, thanks. The XX network is a blockchain. This is now mainnet. We have 500 nodes live. We have, it's run by the foundation out of Cayman. It is the result of several years of hard work to incorporate two aspects. One is the privacy. And maybe I could talk about how we do that. That's the mixing, and it's different from the privacy in eCash. And then I could talk about the quantum resistance and the consensus, if you like. So
that'd be awesome.
The way that privacy is achieved in XX Network is pretty much unique in the blockchain space. We certainly pioneered it, and actually it is unique, and it's based on a breakthrough in mixing. So I invented mixing in 79, and there's been more than 5,000 articles that reference my original article. And no one has really come up with something that's fundamentally faster or better, in my opinion. But I hadn't really actually worked on mixing for like a decade or more. I was at the crypto conference, which is the success, is the continuation of the conference series that I founded, sponsored by the International Association for Cryptologic Research, which I founded and which has, three flagship conferences each year, plus the half a dozen, workshops and so on around the world. So, but the main flagship conference is the one in Santa Barbara, where it was launched, right? And so I was there, and that was like a couple months after the Snowden announcements. And, I was just like, kind of shocked by those, because most people in the community thought that I really believed that the government was spying on everyone. And that's kind of the type of person I was. A lot of the people in that community work for, defense contractors, they're academics. So they all figured that I was the one who wouldn't be surprised by this at all. But I was shocked it was never clear to me one way or the other whether the government was spying on everyone or not. And when we found out they were, I noticed that basically out of the 600 or 700 people at the event, no one seemed to be that shocked. And I was shocked by that and troubled. And so I decided to try to do something about it. So I went back to the drawing board and found a way to speed mixing up like about by a factor of, say, 1,000. And is we call it CMIX. And then I was, someone dragged me to a blockchain event I met with, I saw what was going on with some of the major projects. I kind of just sat in on their meetings and got a sense that I wasn't that impressed, to tell you the truth. I thought, there's too big an opportunity here just to kind of leave these people to their own devices. So I decided to just jump in with all four and make a crypto, a blockchain project that implemented this breakthrough mixing, which we call CMIX, and also that would have the strongest type of cryptography. Because, I wasn't really fooled that, I'd done a lot of what's called crypto analysis, breaking codes for companies and stuff, like not illegally, but for really big companies, and had a fair amount of success with that. And I realized I ran into some defense, kind of related codes and stuff. And I could see the difference between this kind of stuff the government uses to protect their own secrets and the rest of the stuff that they want other countries to use and companies. And so I...
Have they made a movie about your life yet? Because I would love because that sounds awesome.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't have to go into a lot of details of the crazy stuff. There were two companies in Switzerland that I visited, and I broke their stuff. It later turned out they were run by the CIA. It's now public, and the Swiss are all bent out of shape about it. It's a whole thing, you know. There's a lot of things that I broke. What's called the Swift coder, which is a little blue box that every Swift terminal in the world use for their security. It was an encryption box that was built by this company, but I had broke the code, and so they had to pay me to fix it. It was a whole thing. Anyways, you know, there's just a lot of crazy stuff that, you know, so no one knows that the government could have listened in, anyone could have listened in all that stuff. It really, you know, when I broke this, the it was called the Great Ted Coder, which is the same as the Swift Coder, that on a single flip chart sheet in this guy's office at their headquarters, and he nearly died. And every time I'd see him at the conferences, he was just go on and on about how he still has that flip chart in his safe and all this stuff. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff, but the point is that I realized that in order to, and it, just recently, you can see it in the presidential directive in the US that all these agencies have to improve their encryption against quantum resistance. You know, if you read between the lines there, it's pretty clear that now they're saying basically all VPN traffic, all fixed link encryption has to be done with the highest level of technology. And that's basically, you know, that's basically what I said we would use, and we do use it for our consensus. I mean, so what is XX Network? It's two things. It is a quantum resistant consensus algorithm that runs at 3,500 transactions per second, payment transactions per second, on computers that are 1/10 server class, small computers. The cheapest computers you can rent on Amazon, from 100 to 1,200 nodes, we demonstrated, ran it for 10 days. So it could probably run, it might be able to run 10x faster, which is pretty much global payments, you know, all you could eat. If you run it on server class computers, it scales to any size network. And its consensus is quantum resistant and very efficient. And so what that means is it's very difficult to take down. You know, that's one of the issues. If you, you know, governments might have an interest in taking down a cryptocurrency because, you know, there's a big global sanctions and all this stuff. It's quite high stakes. So this is, we've demonstrated, now it's not currently running, but we are going to cut over to it as soon as we get it comported to Rust, you know, because right now we're running in Golang it's in Golang and we're running, you know, going to port it to Rust because we're running in Rust now. But so that's the one part of it. And the other part of it is those same nodes are doing the CMIX protocol. And this is really interesting because it provides a very high grade of mixing. It's like every second or half second, there's a single batch. All messages that come in are perfectly mixed together and come out in one batch. So you get an anonymity set with uniform probabilities. No other system can do that. And now has also quantum resistant end-to-end encryption. And we have the XX Messenger, which is on the iOS, you know, the Android and the Apple, you know, app stores. Try it. I use it all the time. It's a great messenger, basic messenger with a group chat and, you know, it's highly secure. And if you click on a message, you can see the five nodes that were chosen randomly around the world where your message was routed through, and along with 1,000 other messages and mixed at each stage. So it's pretty fun to see that. And we've got tens of thousands of users, and we're adding some really cool stuff to it very soon. And we'll probably be announcing that shortly that will really broaden the use cases. But it's unique in that, you know, every major messenger out there, the people who operate it know who's talking to whom and when and often from where and who your friends are. They have your whole contact list. None of that applies to XX Messenger. That all stays, you know, what goes on in the phone stays in it, never leaves the phone, your phone. So there are no contacts or upload. There is no there. We don't have a central server. It's all totally distributed across, you know, 500 nodes.
Sounds like my kind of product.
By now, you've probably heard all about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, and you might have even already started investing in them. But did you know that you could invest in cryptocurrencies through your retirement account? That's right. With iTrust Capital, you can buy and sell cryptocurrencies from a crypto IRA and get all the same tax advantages as a traditional IRA. So iTrust Capital allows you to invest in over 24 of the most popular cryptocurrencies. And unlike the stock market, you can buy and sell 24 hours a day. The iTrust Capital platform is easy to use, and it only takes a few minutes to create your account. And setting up an IRA is free, and iTrust's fees are low. It's time to start taking control of your financial future. And with iTrust Capital, you can get all the tax benefits of a retirement account while investing in crypto. So visit itrust.capital/crypto101 to start investing today. Again, that's itrust.capital/crypto101. Taxes and conditions may apply, fees apply, and cryptocurrencies are a speculative investment with risk of loss. And iTrust Capital Incorporated does not provide legal, investment, or tax advice. Consult with a qualified legal, investment, or tax professional.
Recently, I saw this survey. It's in the form of an infographic. About 1,500 people were asked, like, what is it you don't like about Web 2? And what is it you're hoping for with Web 3? You know, I thought that was a pretty decent project to really ask people. And it was pretty in-depth. It summarized in the infographic. I mean, truth is, the main thing is privacy. People, that's the big thing they're hoping for, and they want control over their own data. And that's basically what we're doing, but we're doing it with this quantum resistant consensus, so it can't be taken down. That's XX Network.
I love it. Can you give us the 101 version of just what quantum computing even is?
Well, it is. There's a guy. I've been to a lot of those crypto conferences that I organize, you know, and the ones around the world and stuff like that, and so I know a lot of these people. It's funny, you know. So there's a good friend of mine, Gilles Brassard, and he showed up one of the early conferences, like, you know, with shorts and sunglasses and wild, you know, Hawaiian prints and stuff. And he gave this kind of humorous presentation. You know, a lot of people would show up in a suit and stuff like that back in those days. And he introduced quantum cryptography, so this was kind of the early days. Charles Bennett, he had collaborated, so on and so forth. It's quite interesting. So I'm involved in that stuff from the very early stages, but the Shor algorithm, you know, was just like a breakthrough, just a crazy thing that showed that if you have this factoring or some kind of, you know, very systematic encryption algorithm, you can break it with a quantum computer all day long and real easily. And that's the shocking thing. So-called public key cryptography, the kind of cryptography you choose widely, all the, you know, the crypto in the major blockchains, it's all of that ilk, all trivially broken with a quantum computer. You have to have a big enough one, but it will break it, no problem. And that's something that, you know, it's unanticipated, and it's not easy to fix. You know, a lot of times you say, oh, we'll just substitute the encryption algorithms. We'll just switch that library. Oh, it's all very modular. You know, that's a lot of, that's not done really true. When you try to build a blockchain that has strong quantum resistance, like the kind that Biden said all federal agencies have to use for their, like, VPNs and stuff, like, right away, if you read the presidential directive, I mean, this is serious stuff.
I didn't hear about that.
That's that. You can't just add that on. It's a whole different approach. So we had to just come up with a special way to make these so-called compact endorsement signatures so that it's efficient enough, because it's very clunky stuff. And so we have also in XX Network now, the coins are, the wallet actually hold quantum resistant keys in reserve. So we're not using them operationally, as I mentioned, but they are there behind the scenes as a backup in our system. And people have been very interested in that technology. So you don't have to pay the price for, you know, right now, but you always have them to fall back on. So that's something we have.
You know, you just mentioned the Biden, you know, sort of encouraging all, or not encouraging, but basically it's a national security memorandum promoting, yeah. You know, everybody has to, and he's describing these things called cryptanically relevant quantum computers, CRQCs, and they basically sound, like WMDs, but
yeah,
just electronic.
No, it's serious stuff, believe me. And don't forget, you know, China might be very well ahead of the US in this stuff. And it's, you know, if you know, there's actually two of those directives, and look at, wow. You know, you'll read that there, that all the national security relevant stuff is not even covered in this. So for the stuff they really care about, that's a whole different level, not even touched on. But then for all the basic communication, they want this highest level. And then, okay, you know, every agency that, you know, maybe have an encrypted website or something, you know, they can fix that. They got plenty of time. They can adapt the national standards. But don't be fooled by the dates in there. Don't forget this all has to be reported now to the National Security Council. I mean, it's a big deal.
And I think a lot of this is probably stemming from the, you know, the increased geopolitical tensions between Russia and America. Do you have any thoughts on that, maybe?
Well, I mean, to me, you know, this sort of soft power and this sanctions thing, you know, if you're into geopolitics, that's the big thing these days, right? And so the big workaround for that is cryptocurrencies. And all these countries, including the U.S., have said they're going to have their own. And that's why. This is a very high stakes, big deal thing. And if you think for a minute that one of these major agencies doesn't have plans to take down some of these chains in case, you know, the people they don't like start using them to work around these, then I guess you're not really understanding how these people work. You know, they don't forget, these are the guys that had all this secret capability during the Second World War and sat there and watched people like passenger ships get sunk because they didn't want to reveal that they had it.
Who did that?
I believe that was the case. The U.S. did that, I believe. When you break codes, I don't want to malign the NSA, believe me, but I think there's stuff like that. When you know how to break a code, you don't just put it in the New York Times. You try to keep that secret from your adversaries. It's just like, you know, those DEA busts that you always hear about. They lied in the court. They say, oh, we just happened to be at that place in Oklahoma and saw the guy unloading the cocaine. You know, we didn't hear it from the NSA intercept that gave it to the DEA. You heard about that whole controversy? It's all about hiding, you know, this capability. Whatever, that's part of their culture, and that's what enhances its, you know,
it's the art of war.
You know, maybe if less, you know, assuming your adversaries don't know that you have it, maybe that's, I don't know. I don't bother myself with all that stuff, but I mean, you just see it all over the, you know, I see it all over the media. It's a huge issue.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to kind of the essence of a question that we kind of get a lot here at Crypto 101 from listeners. And it's just kind of around this idea of like, hey, like this technology, this cryptocurrency stuff, this is so powerful. Mm. Won't the government just shut it down? Won't it just ban it? And, you know, we saw kind of, you know, back in the late 1990s, these crypto wars where they were trying to ban encryption.
Yeah. Yeah. And I stayed out of that.
Ah.
So, yeah, but I almost went to, you know, jail or whatever for setting crypto free. But then I just step back from the crypto wars because I was more into the privacy thing than the actual encryption. But then after the Snowden revelations and seeing the reaction of my, you know, the colleagues in the community to it, I decided to come back in and really, you know, try to do something, try to make something that could be used mobile phone to mobile phone, you know, something yeah. that would actually allow the public to use mixing technology to hide their associations, you know, from the government. Because, you know, see, in, you know, in intelligence work against that's aimed at any kind of organization or the public, what's much more interesting is to see who talks to whom and when and from where than to the data, than what they say. Because real spies will just kind of speak in code and lie and misdirect you. And, you know, but who you talk to and when, you know, that stuff does not lie. And it's historically, it's been much more manageable, you know, data capture. And, you know, amazingly, in most countries in the free world, there has been no law against the wholesale intercept of that kind of data. So in the US, we've always had what we've got called mail covers and pen registers for paper mail and phone calls that would record all the addresses on the envelopes that you send and receive, how much they weigh and which phone numbers you called and called you and for how long you spoke. That was all fair game. Government could just collect that without any limitation. And that's very valuable information. And so, you know, the Facebook people often, you can see them saying, you know, it's the social graph. That's our main asset, right? They know who's friends with whom, who's talking to whom, and all that. That's
it makes a whole lot of sense now that Facebook got as big as it did. Now that you put that in context, it was a perfect storm.
Well, yeah, there's, you know, I mean, just if you look at Amazon and you look at Google, I mean, these, you know, we've seen these, you know, there's only a handful of giant companies in the world like that, and they, you know, they have created unfair advantage by just spying on everybody wholesale and using that to manipulate people and situation and get, you know, ridiculous unfair competitive advantage and increase their global power. And it's just sort of, you know, it's kind of decimated a lot of culture, you know, and diversity and opportunity for, you know, new things. It's been at a huge cost. I mean, look at the newspapers, bookstores, you know, everything. You know, it's just it's really. And then, you know, don't forget your, you know, Cambridge Analytica et al. Right? I mean, you know, but it's just the impact that's had on people because they just feel like, wow, I can't fight this. Either I'm just going to go live in a cabin or I'm just going to have to accept this because I don't really have an alternative. And that's kind of what XX Network is. You know, we view ourselves as like something you can actually vote with your feet. Use XX Network. Maybe you don't have any top secret things or you're not, you know, but use it because you're providing cover traffic for those people who do. If you believe this is important, use it and support it. And, you know, then maybe someday you might need it. It'll be there for you.
Well, that's amazing. And there's a lot of different people that are in our audience, aside from just the 101 listeners. There's a lot of founders in crypto that I was surprised and pleased to find out that actually listen to this podcast on a regular basis. Hmm. If someone wants to build on top of the XX Network and build something more, aside from that messaging app or utilize it somehow, what's the best way for them to get involved? And just what can be built on your protocol?
Okay, well, I should probably preface my comment by saying, you know, you can run a node and you can stake and all that stuff. It's all good. So, you know, it's quite a vibrant community. And the truth is we have opened the APIs to the CMIX pub and, you know, they're public and open source and everything for a long time. Better part of a year. Not that many people have taken us up on writing stuff for it that we know of, because that's one of the things, you know, people could be offering services on the network and we wouldn't see it. That's one of the interesting aspects of, but like, let me just say this, watch this space. We have some very significant announcements in that area that will be coming up in a matter of, you know, very soon. And I can say that they are.
You don't want to ruin any surprises.
Yeah, we're going to go way out on a limb to open up all kinds of uses and encourage all kinds of people this in a big way, and that's coming up. So we're excited, super excited about that. I don't think I should say more at this point, but yeah. So we haven't stopped it. It's kind of tricky stuff, and I think we are aware of some people who've written their own stuff, but it's not that much. But this will change.
Okay. Well, I'm excited, and you know, one of the things I kind of think about sometimes is, you know, with Bitcoin and Ethereum, you know, is this technology that you built, is this something that you could build, you know, a secure messaging system on top of Bitcoin or Ethereum, who kind of already have, you know, a huge holder base, and they have, you know, the regulatory kind of clarity, and, you know, they're these awesome platforms. Would a system like XX Network be able to run on top of Bitcoin or Ethereum? And what would you kind of think about something like that?
Well, let me just say that, you know, I've been in conversations with Vitalik and some core devs for Bitcoin on this kind of thing since 2017, I think. And to be really frank, it's probably easier to, you know, build a new thing that's, I mean, our you know, 3,500, 35,000, let's say, transactions per second. You know, that's Alipay, WeChat, and Visa all rolled into one, I believe. You know, that is global electronic payments. Got it covered. You know, that's miles away. That's a big step up from what those. So, you know, we had a lot of conversations about side chains and this and that.
Yeah, there's a lot of these layer twos.
Really, I don't want to disparage anything, but I would, you know, it's like, In the security and privacy worlds, both, there is a kind of generally very strongly believed principle that's more or less parallel, which is you can't add it on, you got to build it in.
I like that. That's a good saying.
Yeah, it's really, you run, you know, it's, it, I mean, obviously, it can't be absolutely true, but it is. It is generally what people think, and there's a lot to it. And so,
yeah. And the only reason why I really ask is just because it's, you know, it's so easy for a user who's already on Ethereum just to bridge over to a layer two network that's using, zero knowledge proofs. And it already has kind of that privacy built into it, but I guess, you know, it's not the same level of privacy and mixing and quantum security. So it really maybe does, you know, necessitate that ground up, but it just seems.
Well, make no mistake, what we provide is real privacy. You know, your IP address stays with you, and that's something that can, as I mentioned earlier, undo all kinds of privacy that you might have out there. So you could use some fancy little tricky things, but it's not really going to solve the privacy problem. And you know the kind of transaction flow I'm talking about is like, you know, don't forget the Satoshi vision, right? Which was, you know, payments, really. It's not just the, so it's, I think, you know, and there's another thing, I don't want to really comment on it, but it is a public fact that there's something called Liquifinity. Liquifinity, you can look it up and see that I'm associated with it. And it's, you know, it is a way to do cross-chain payments in a secure manner. And I think when you start, if to combine something like that with some of these very established, kind of more on the store of value, but not really with the transaction bandwidth, then I think, you know, it's possible to make a really ideal kind of convenient integrated mechanism. I don't know if that's too sketchy, but you sort of get my drift, Bryce, or?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, okay. Yeah. And, you know, I'm curious, is there anything else kind of that's about the XX network that we missed? You know, something that we didn't ask that you want to make sure the audience knows before we get to our closing questions.
Yeah, I'm just mulling that over. I mean, I covered the stuff that's out there. But, you know, as I said before, watch this space. You know, in the next short period of time, we'll be announcing some major expansions of scope and integration that I think will, you know, provide tons of avenue for developers. And really, I mean, to my perspective, XX Network, you know, I mean, you could say, I don't want to, I've heard it said that maybe I'm the guy who's been working on Web3 for like 40 years.
Yeah.
And a handful of years ago, I said that XX Network was going to be, you know, the thing that would really take Web3 to the public, even though that terminology wasn't floating around at that moment. And so I believe that we have the opportunity to really make a full range of useful things available to the general public without them having to even be involved in some of the messier, you know, mechanics of blockchain stuff. But that's not to say that we're going to leave the, you know, the community behind, but we can offer Web3 to everybody on the planet. And that's kind of the vision. And it's not as, you know, it's, we have the technology to do it and we intend to do it. So I should have said that.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. And now it's funny because, you know, the last question that we ask every guest on the show, it kind of is a different form, or it's kind of a version of this, but it's, you know, of all the people that you've run across in your life, you know, who's inspired you academically, who has challenged you, who's been a role model. So I'm going to ask you that question, but it's funny because most cryptographers and computer scientists would probably say you. So who do you even get to say?
Well, I guess that makes it easy for me then. You know, I honestly, I guess I don't want to say I pride myself on, but I think I have tried to follow my principles and do what I think really is the needs to be done as the best possible thing to do to push, you know, to try to make the world a better place. That's been my ethos and my mantra. And if you look back at, you know, each decision and what, you know, the stuff I've done along this cryptography path, it's all makes sense in that, within that framework. So I guess I've been a little bit too busy just trying to figure out the right thing to do and not been paying a lot of attention, not looking really left or right. I've just been focused straight ahead.
Absolutely zoned in, locked in, dialed in, not given any time to anything except the XX Network.
There you go.
Well, I love it. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us here at the Crypto 101 podcast and spending the hour with us. You know, we're really excited about everything you're building, and we'd love to have you back on again for another discussion here in the,
sure.
in the near future.
Yeah, it's a blast. I really enjoyed it meeting both of you, and this was really interesting. Thanks for giving me the opportunity and the good questions, and it was great speaking with you.
Wonderful. All right, everyone at home, stay tuned. We'll be back later in the week with some more guests.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.